Universal Service Fund. It provides $8 billion a year for telecommunications programs geared toward underserved populations. That includes high-speed internet service in rural areas. Kara Semler of the South Dakota Telecommunications Association worries about the impact if the challenge is successful.
Children will be missing out on educational opportunities. Businesses will lose their competitiveness.
Industry groups say service rates for customers benefiting from the fund will double if it's struck down. The plaintiffs contend the fee mechanism used to prop up the fund is more like a tax, meaning Congress should have the oversight. Semler says shifting that power would result in annual funding uncertainty for an industry that relies on long-term planning. Cell phone service providers and other telecom companies pay for the fee that's at the center of the legal argument. Those costs are passed along to consumers across the country through their monthly bills. Semler says it's a small price to pay to maintain critical broadband infrastructure in rural pockets.
It's that ongoing operation, maintenance, and affordability of the product. It does no good to have infrastructure in the ground if it becomes unaffordable for South Dakota consumers to use.
Semler says they've had productive conversations with South Dakota's congressional delegation about Plan B strategies, but she acknowledges the budget-cutting tone in Washington, D.C. right now, while adding it would be hard for state government to fill any sudden funding gaps. This is Mike Moen for Greater Dakota News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 10th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Mike Moen, Brian Bull, Alex Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Powder, Judith Ruiz Branch, and Mark Moran. The director, Evening News, is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Mike Fdeklis. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Now stay tuned for Coast Range Radio.
I got his name wrong again.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. The Forest Service is using the threat of wildfires to justify a drastic expansion of commercial logging on our public lands. That is the basic contention of an investigative reporting series from Nathan Gillis at Columbia Insight. And many of us in the environmental world have long thought this to be the case, but this series brings receipts, including internal Forest Service documents, emails, and more. In my view, this is a scandal that should be getting far more attention. The Forest Service has received billions of dollars in recent years on top of their normal budget specifically to protect communities from wildfire. If they're using those funds to push commercial logging, they're not only not making communities safer, they may very well be putting those communities and forests at greater risk. So to talk about the series, as well as some of the other excellent science reporting he's done, I'm joined today by Nathan Gillis. Before we get to the interview, I just want to really quickly address Trump's recent executive orders calling for a massive expansion of logging on public lands. So first, they don't do anything to change things on the ground in the near term. It's unclear whether they are a PR stunt or a serious threat, though we should obviously treat them as serious. And I'll have someone on soon to discuss the executive orders and other federal forest policy under the Trump administration. But for now, this just underlines why it is so important that we take action to push the Forest Service during the Northwest Forest Plan Amendment comment period. That comment period ends on March 17th, so please take just a few minutes to speak up for our forests. I have links to comment writing guides and petitions in the podcast episode description. You can also find resources at coastrange.org or whatever forest conservation group you trust, or you can go right to the Forest Service's website. My email is michael@coastrange.org. I love hearing feedback and show ideas, so drop me a line. Okay, let's get to the interview. Nathan, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, we have, as usual for this show, a lot to get through, so let's jump right in. What is the basic thesis of this recent series? And then I'd like to kind of dig into each one in piece.
Well, the thesis, I could probably describe best with just kind of the genesis of the story. Back in November of last year, I was talking with a lawyer from Wild Earth Guardians, and he had a trove of documents he had received from the Forest Service through public records request. And his request was related to how Region 6, which is the Pacific Northwest, was going to meet its timber targets. And it was pretty clear from looking through the documents, just a cursory look even, that the Forest Service was intending to use different authorities and tools associated with the wildfire crisis to meet its timber targets. So essentially, it's a big documents story, and we've been breaking down what those documents mean, what are the various tools and authorities, and that's essentially what the first article in the series is. The second article in the series looks at a specific project that is tied to the wildfire crisis, and specifically to certain authorities that have been granted the agency through the bipartisan infrastructure law to thin forests as a way to reduce fuel loads.
Yeah, and I love how at least the first two articles are set up, because the first one really gives a really detailed overview of what's going on, and then you get really specific with that second article. So I just liked how you set those up.
Thank you. The intention was originally to do one really long one, but we decided we'd break it up into parts.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Let's go into that first article and talk about what you found, and just give us a little more in depth about your findings there.
Right. Well, so our story sort of begins in 2021 with the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure law. And that law basically allowed for the Forest Service to have some extra emergency authorities to help fast track prevention treatments. Now, around the same time, the Subcommittee on Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies also reached out to the Forest Service to ask how they could increase their board feet of timber from 3 billion board feet. I believe it was actually 2.8 billion in 2021 to 4 billion board feet annually. Among the letters that we received were letters from at the time, Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, to members of the subcommittee describing exactly how they would do that. Now, from then, we get some interesting internal documents, including some emails. Probably the most interesting email is dated to February 2023. In that email, David Lytle, who is then basically he's underneath the chief and the deputy chief of the Forest Service. So he writes, and this email is written to regional forest directors. So he writes to Region 6, Region 8, all the different regions, right? And tells them that we need to increase our board feet. There's this expectation from the secretary and from the chief and deputy chief of the Forest Service that this work needs to be done. Well, we can do that by using the emergency authorities granted to us by Vilsack to increase our timber targets. And we can do this. We can use a wildfire crisis to do this. And then the letter goes into basically calling on the regional foresters to identify various tools and authorities to do that. Well, as I got further into investigating the piece, then we found what these various authorities and tools were. Mm-hmm. They include things like stewardship contracts, which we can go into, the Good Neighbor Authority, which is another tool associated with wildfire crisis, and a whole series of efforts to what's called streamline NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act in order to speed up the process. And they're very clear about why they're doing this exactly. And the reason is that NEPA takes time. NEPA can take time to do this. So what the agency does is they create this thing called NEPA shelf stock. So they have to have so many projects that are so far along in the NEPA process to eventually get approved, right? Well, what happens when you increase your timber targets, right? That means you start to deplete your NEPA stock. And that's essentially what the documents say that they're doing. They talk about how we're depleting our NEPA stock and so forth. What was interesting about doing this story is, as I was reading over these internal documents, I, of course, had to figure out what the heck all these different internal terms use, because they're used mean, right? Because oftentimes they're just acronyms. They're not described, and you have to go backtrack to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
Well, doing so and looking into things like stewardship contracts and the Good Neighbor Authority, it happens that the agency has been saying this publicly for years, that they're doing this exact thing. They're using these tools associated with welfare crisis to meet their timber targets. They've been quite open about them in public documents, which also gave credence to all these internal documents we had, because everything that the agency had been saying internally had also been said publicly, if maybe not as candidly.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I think your article really lays out with a lot of clarity, is breaking down some of that agency speak. I mean, you do go into a lot of detail, but you also show how what they're doing is basically kind of reverse engineering the process. You know, the money was given to them with the direction to protect homes, protect communities, protect and restore forests, not to increase timber targets. So they're saying, let's figure out how under those authorities we can meet our real priority here, or to be, you know, generous to them, one of our other priorities, meeting timber targets. And I want to ask you in a minute about some of the potential negative implications of using this justification to do this other thing. But I also wanted to, when we first spoke, before we started recording, you were saying that you wanted to make a distinction that you're not taking a position here on the underlying science. I really appreciated your thought process on that. So could you talk a little bit about your distinction you're making there?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, with these stories, we specifically with the first story where we lay out how the agency has been identifying these various tools and authorities associated with the welfare crisis to meet their timber targets, We establish that fact. We don't actually establish that there's necessarily any wrongdoing on the agency's behalf, right? That they're doing anything wrong. So, I mean, their argument, and it's the same argument that the timber associations have as well, is that this is basically a win-win scenario, that we can essentially thin these forests and take out the wood and use it, you know, to build houses or whatever. The reason I'm reluctant to take a side on that is I just haven't investigated it enough to have a clear and informed opinion. That's perhaps not necessarily what your listeners would like to hear, but I try to be really careful in how I approach these stories and what kind of evidence is available. And I'm certainly not saying that evidence doesn't exist out there. Obviously, there's a lot of lawsuits that have gone on against various projects over the years, and there's undoubtedly a lot of paperwork out there that could point to that if that is indeed happening, if the agency is cutting corners, as it were. But we don't have the evidence. We didn't have the evidence. I didn't have the evidence when writing the story to take that leap.
I think it's important to have folks like you say, not taking a position on the science, on whether they're following the science, on the strength of the science itself, because that's not what this piece is about. And that's actually the reason that I was so interested in talking with you about this piece. You know, I've talked with Forest Service fire researchers. I've talked with conservation advocates. You know, the debate around the science can be endless, and it is fascinating. But I think just as important is, what are the underlying motivations here? What are the true priorities? Obviously, science can be interpreted different ways. So what are the values being expressed here in what they're actually trying to do on the ground? And I'm not saying you're taking a position on that either, but I have long maintained that the Forest Service has not done enough to demonstrate sufficient credibility on this issue to be doing these massive landscape alterations, and they haven't demonstrated that they've learned the lessons from the past. And again, those are my words, not yours, but
you were about to go into a little bit of a summary of some of those specific authorities that they're using.
I mean, going back to your last point, I think I would just say that I think it's really difficult to fact check these agencies.
Yeah. And so and that's why trust is important, you know? So I don't want to go too deep into the weeds here. I really recommend that everybody read the article themselves. But could you just take me through some of the kind of authorities that they're using and why some of these things that sound so great, like a good neighbor agreement, actually have potential negative implications?
Right. We all like having good neighbors, right?
Yeah.
So how stewardship contracts work is essentially they use the value of the timber that is sold to pay for restoration work. There are multiple benefits from this from the Forest Service perspective. One is that they get to hold on to some of those receipts as opposed to sending them back to the Treasury Department. So that's a benefit. The other is that if you include enough high value timber in a sale, you can pay to do the thinning and restoration work that you need to prevent wildfires. So this means that the sale of bigger trees pays for the thinning of smaller trees that might have little or no commercial value in them.
Right. And what could be problematic about that?
Well, and certainly we quote several environmentalists who are concerned about that particular mechanism. Good neighbor authority basically works in the same way. When we interviewed people who run the Good Neighbor Authority in Washington and Oregon, we got kind of a similar response, basically that the sale of larger trees can be used to pay for restoration, particularly the thinning of smaller trees. Although the Washington Department of Natural Resources gave us a very careful answer when we asked that question of them, because I think they maybe saw it coming.
Uh-huh.
Basically saying that they don't do this, that they look for whatever treatment is necessary at the time, and they don't try to incentivize their projects that way. When we talked to the head of the Good Neighbor Authority for the Oregon Department of Forestry, by contrast, he basically told us exactly what the timber industry told us when we asked about how stewardship contracts work. And that essentially bigger trees can be used to pay for removing smaller trees.
So I think this is a great spot to dig into the second article and really drill down into what some of this looks like on the ground. Could you talk a bit about that second article?
Well, the second article is really more about the application of categorical exclusions, which is something we also talk about in the first article. Essentially, that works by a categorical exclusion allows a project to be categorically excluded from the NEPA requirement to produce an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment. So it's considerably less paperwork. It takes considerably less time. Environmentalists, however, have argued that categorical exclusions give the agency exclusive authority to essentially determine whether or not a project should be excluded from the NEPA process. They can essentially say it should be excluded from the NEPA process and then follow through with it. And then the only way to fact check that is then to have them essentially be litigated. Now, again, whether or not the agency is misappropriating these tools is another question. But the second story goes into what the application of a categorical exclusion looks like in Region 6 on the ground. And the project that we looked at was the 27 road fuel break project on the Mount Hood National Forest. Essentially, it's a fuel break. So what they're trying to do is they're cutting down trees, thinning trees, however you want to describe it, in a narrow band around a series of roads in the National Forest, with the intention that this is going to provide a break that the fire cannot, so that the fire cannot jump from one area to another, essentially. Now we can go into some of the critiques of the science of the project, which are pretty interesting.
Absolutely. Tell me about some of the critiques of the project.
The critique was pretty interesting because essentially it boils down to whether or not the Forest Service appropriately used high-resolution data to try to identify whether or not there were trees on the ground.
Like large trees.
Large trees.
Right.
Yeah, large trees on the ground, I should say, yeah. So whether or not there was old growth on the ground. And they did this by using something called the Old Growth Structural Index, which is called OGSI 200. And this gets a little wonky, but it's a series of definitions that defines where old growth trees are found, right? It's also a series of maps. It also has incredibly low resolution, and the agency has said that they should not be using it in creating projects because the resolution is not high enough. Mm-hmm. Now, the claim that a whole series of environmental organizations placed on the Forest Service and the Mountain National Forest was that the agency essentially used this low resolution mapping system, OGSI 200, as kind of a broad first pass that allowed them to eliminate all but two of the units in the project area from consideration. Now, why does all this matter? This matters because across the river in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, the agency did something completely different, wherein they worked with the Washington Department of Natural Resources to get high resolution data to try to find where these old growth trees were with inside that project. And that project is the Little White Salmon project. It's also another wildfire crisis project. And in that case, OGSI 200 was used, but it was used as kind of a starting point. And then they filled in the information with high resolution data, including LIDAR, which is kind of the gold standard for finding trees on the ground. And as a consequence, they found more old growth trees on the ground.
Shocking. So I really want to make sure we have time to discuss some of the other things you've written about. So where should folks find them?
Yeah, they're up on columbiainsight.org. And great. I would suggest going there and checking out all of our other stuff too that we do. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I find that to be an excellent environmental news website. I've been really impressed with the work you all do there. Is there anything that we've missed on this piece, on this series, that you want to make sure gets included? And actually, what's coming up next in the series? Are there going to be future articles?
Yeah, we plan to write two more. The due date is to be determined. I'm still trying to put some research together, but basically looking at some more of these mechanisms and looking at more specific projects and how they're applied.
Well, let's turn to some of the other things you've written about. I've really appreciated reading some of your stuff on assisted migration, heat and tree mortality, like what happened in the heat dome. So let's start with assisted migration, if that's okay. Actually, you just came out with a piece for the Sierra Club magazine, but first, for anyone that's not familiar with that term, just what is assisted migration, and talk about what the arguments for it are, what some of the concerns are.
Right. Well, so assisted migration is the idea that people can, and some would argue, should help species adapt and move as climate change changes or continues. And with trees and other plant species, the idea essentially is that they have ranges. Plants have growing ranges in which they can grow, which are dependent upon temperature and precipitation. And there's been some good evidence to suggest that in the northern hemisphere, that as temperatures increase, plants are slowly, their ranges, I should say, are slowly migrating northward in latitude and upward in elevation. Now, the trees themselves can't keep up with that pace of change. So the idea is that people should help them move. There are all kinds of problems with this, though, in terms of its application, including that moving tree species into new areas might be problematic because they might go invasive. The flip side is you might move them in and they might not be able to adapt, or what's called recruit, that is, produce, you know, seedlings in that area. I don't think I included it in the batch of stories I sent to you, but I did a story for Columbia Insight last year that looked at redwoods and sequoias, because there's a big push to move redwoods and sequoias into the Pacific Northwest. The problem with that is that the trees aren't recruiting as you would expect. They're not producing seedlings, or they're not producing enough seedlings, even though they've been here for a long time. So that means that we would have to, if we're moving these species, we would have to basically kind of help them, continue to help them along over a long period of time. And that might not be what we want. The other issue with assisted migration is that the models that are being used, what are called species distribution models, are really simplistic. They're based just entirely on precipitation and temperature, and they don't account for things like things like fungi, for instance. And so this was the story I wrote for Sierra Magazine recently that reviews a study that came out last summer. And in this study, basically, the researchers looked at tree species in the eastern U.S., two species. It was beech and maple, sugar maple, I believe. And they looked at the different fungi that are associated with them, the mycorrhizal fungi. And they found that essentially the trees needed their mycorrhizal fungal partners to move with them if they're going to be successful. It was a really cool study. It came out of State University of New York. They did a fantastic job in their design. And it's pretty clear that, yeah, you're going to need to move these fungi as well. But then, you know, how do you do that? And how do you do that without introducing potentially pathogenic fungi that might damage the system in the process?
Yeah, it's so incredibly complicated. And there's so many factors, as you're pointing out, that we just don't fully understand yet or even begin to understand. It's almost like ecosystems are like unfathomably complex and we and we shouldn't be messing with our earth lightly.
I have an anecdote for that, by the way.
So
right before I found that study, I was writing a story on blue carbon, which is an interesting thing in of itself, and spruce trees on the coasts of Washington, Oregon. I was taking a boat out to look at some of these places. I got to take my son with me, which was pretty fun. And one of the researchers I was talking with, you know, I told him my interest in assisted migration and why I thought it was problematic for any number of reasons. And he, you know, and he blurts out, "It was mycorrhizal fungi all along. That's what's going to be, you know that, right?" And then like 2 days later, the study pops up in my email. I'm like, oh, damn, he was right. Okay, let's check that out.
Oh, yeah. It's so amazing. And I love that you sent me those articles because it just touches on so much of the complexity that we're dealing with in this changing climate of like, how much should we be intervening, you know, to adapt versus letting nature take its course, or versus putting more of our energy into stopping carbon pollution, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, and at some point we do have to, you know, try to take action, but how we do that and how much action we take, I mean, these are really important things to be debating, researching, considering. So I really appreciate your reporting on that.
Yeah. Well, and then I know the other story we're going to talk about was kind of the work I've done on heat in trees. I think
just about to lead into that. Perfect. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I think, you know, the larger, you know, when you do a big document story, like the one we, you know, started this interview off with, you kind of can lose track of the big picture. And the big picture of that all of this is happening in is essentially that it's getting, in some cases, just too hot for some of these species to survive where they're at. And we've seen massive tree die-offs all over the place. And, you know, and kudos to the Forest Service, because they're one of the agencies that have been tracking this for years, in fact.
Yeah.
They've been
yeah.
doing a lot of research on it, and they have the data sets. And most of the research on tree, or I should say a lot of the research on tree die-offs is based on Forest Service data sets that they've kept over the years. But, you know, we're seeing a tree die-offs from a phenomenon called a hot drought, which is happening everywhere. It's, you know, it's happening with Western red cedars here in our region. It's happening with Douglas firs. It's happening with beech trees in Germany. It's happening with eucalyptus trees in Australia. And the gist of that is essentially when it gets hot, not only does the soil dry out, but the air dries out as well. And in order to adapt to this, what trees do is they close their stomata. Right. And that's where they take in carbon dioxide from the air and then rip that carbon apart and then use that to build their bodies and then to build defenses. Well, in really high hot drought circumstances, what happens is the trees, through closing their stomata, go through a process that's called carbon starvation. They simply do not get enough carbon to build their bodies and then to build their defenses. So in a lot of cases, what we're seeing with, you know, for instance, true fir die-offs, this is a factor of hot drought affecting them and basically making them too weak to be able to withstand insect attacks. Same thing with the large die-off of Douglas firs in Southwest Oregon. It's the same process. Western red cedars, those trees are incredibly resilient to all kinds of insects and fungal attacks. And they're simply dying from not, you know, growing enough. You know, it's like that. I hate to quote Bob Dylan because I'm more of a Phil Oaks guy, but there's a, you know, that Bob Dylan quota, he who's not busy being bored and is busy dying. And that's essentially how trees function. They have to keep moving and they have to keep growing, right?
Yeah.
So that's a problem. And that's happening everywhere. And then on top of this, we're also having these extreme heat events like the 2021 heat dome. That was particularly problematic and worrisome because essentially, it just got too hot for cells to exist, you know, for these cells to function. So the term that the scientists used was widespread scorching. And if you remember, if you went out after the heat dome and you looked at trees that faced the south, they all had just, they were just torched. They just orange everywhere. And I certainly saw it with cedars where I lived. And what happens essentially is when you reach about 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which is where about where we got with some of these trees, cell walls start to break down, proteins break down, and that's problematic. And also at the same time when that's happening, then you know, these trees aren't photosynthesizing. They're not taking in carbon, so they're also getting weakened from that process too.
Yeah, that was such a scary eye-opener, that heat dome. And that really does, like you said a minute ago, bring it back to that bigger picture. As we start to wrap up, just bringing it all the way back to the Forest Service, to these wildfire treatments, almost everyone agrees something has to be done. You know, we have locked in, no matter what we do today, tomorrow, the rest of this century, we have locked in a certain amount of climate chaos here, and we are going to be seeing these massive tree die-offs. There's no way to avoid some of the things that are coming down the pipe. And so it's not a question of, should we just let nature take its course or not? I firmly think that we have to do something. We have an obligation to the natural world. But the question is, what to do? Who has the trust and credibility to act? You know, and what are our incentives and values there? So I think that is a through line between all of the things that we've talked about today. And I've really appreciated getting to have this conversation with you. Your work is excellent. And you also, in addition to writing for Columbia Insight, have your own personal website that folks can go to. Can folks find all of these articles that we've talked about at your personal website? And what is that?
Eventually when I update my website, it's nathangillis.com.
Great. Well, like I said, I really enjoyed talking with you, and I really encourage folks to go to nathangillis.com and read your work, to go to Columbia Insight, read your work there. So thank you so much for joining us on Coast Range Radio. I hope we can have you back again.
All right. Thanks for having me.